Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's Great Conversation features a panel of contributors, including Michaela Saunders, Janine Lane, and Jane Harrison, to discuss the new anthology, Flock, First Nations Stories, Then and Now. The Final Draft Great Conversations podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. I'm Andrew Popel. Every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Final Draft is dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to household names. Every week we look into the issues that drive our storytelling and help you discover more from the books that you love. These are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands. This is unceded land, stolen land. A treaty has never been made in Australia. Now, each of my contributors today have, well, they've contributed a story to this anthology, Flock. It is First Nations stories then and now, and brings together a range of some of not only the most incredible First Nations storytellers, but the most incredible writers, authors, poets working in Australia at the moment. The collection was edited by Ellen Van Nieuwen and features an array of stories exploring issues personal and political that really inform our country at the moment. It's an incredibly exciting collection, and I'm so happy to be able to bring together a panel of people to discuss the importance of these stories, the importance of storytelling, and the impact that these stories can and should have in our world. I've left the audio on this panel, you know, relatively untouched, because I want you to experience the dynamic of having just incredible people in a room, or not in a Zoom room, talking to each other. So please join me as I am joined by Michaela Saunders, Janine Lane, and Jane Harrison to discuss Flock, First Nations Stories, Then and Now. I have an absolutely fantastic collection to introduce to you, and a really special discussion that we're about to have. It's not a format that we usually do here on Final Draft, and I'm excited to introduce a panel of writers, Flock. It is a collection of First Nations stories then and now. The stories promise to roam the landscape of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander storytelling, bringing together voices from across the generations. The collection is edited and features a story from Ellen Van Nieuwen. It features contributions from the likes of Tara June Winch, Tony Birch, and Melissa Lukashenko, as well as the guests that I have joining me today. I'd like to introduce Michaela Saunders, Janine Lane, and Jane Harrison. Welcome. Welcome, each of you. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure, Andrew.
Hi.
Now, I'd like to introduce each of these incredible contributors in a little bit more detail. Michaela Saunders, her story in the collection is called River Story. Michaela is a Guri writer, teacher, and community researcher. Also, we are joined by Janine Lane. Her story in the collection is Forbidden Fruit. Janine is a Wiradjuri poet, writer, and academic from southwest New South Wales. And Jane Harrison's story is Born Still. Jane is a playwright and author descended from the Murawari people. It is just so fantastic to have a panel together to discuss an anthology, because anthologies are always these incredible ways to approach literature with so many ideas. We could probably sit and have a conversation just about any single one of these stories, and there's 20 in the book. But I thought, can we start with this as a collection, this incredible collection of, you know, some of the most incredible storytellers and writers in Australia at the moment? But where does it sit in the broader history of First Nations writing? And where do you feel we're at in terms of listening and acknowledging these stories? Janine, can I ask you to start with that?
Yurudu Murring, everyone. Acknowledging today that I am on the lands of the Ngunnawal peoples in Canberra, pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging, and acknowledge that I'm living on lands never ceded. Thanks. Look, as a gathering, Flock is tremendously important in many ways. Like, First Nations writing is always important because First Nations writing does the job that national history fails to do, which is tell her stories, our histories. We can't rely on national history to do that. As a collection, there's been a dearth of First Nations gatherings or anthologies almost in the last 20 years, as a couple of fantastic collections came out in the early 2000s, like Inside Black Australia, edited by the late Uncle Kevin Gilbert. There was also Paperbark by the University of Queensland Press, a collection of Black writings. And on the West Coast, Rosemary Vandenberg and Brewster's Those Who Remain Will Remember. But then there were no great gatherings of, although there were a lot of good individual works, but historically no great gatherings of work until last year, where we had and early this year, where we've had a really important explosion with and much needed too, in terms of the breadth and the diversity across geography, genre, and gender of our writing community. So last year we had Firefront and a collection of First Nations essays and poetry edited by Alison Whittaker. Homelands Calling by Desert Pea Media, which was a collection of hip-hop lyrics, poems inspired by hip-hop lyrics by a new generation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writers. Flock, that we're talking about, also by Ellen and Gwayu Magabala Books and edited by myself, which has 61 poets and 12 First Nations languages in it. So it's rich and timely that we have this collection, and the name itself is incredibly powerful.
I think it's a beautiful collection. I really enjoyed, it was sent to us in the mail a little bit before it came out, I was just so struck by the beautiful cover for starters. And then, you know, of course I read Ellen's always very beautiful and crystalline and generous introduction. And I knew I was in for a treat, you know. And I particularly enjoy the way that they've curated it and kind of let all of the stories move into each other, so it kind of tells a bigger story of, you know, a kind of meta narrative of Aboriginal storytelling or Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander storytelling over the last 25 years. Yeah, there was stuff I'd already read in here, and there were writers I hadn't read or I hadn't heard of, and I think it's a really beautiful collection. I'm really stoked to be part of this collection, actually. River Story was the second story I ever wrote in my whole life, and it's very dear to me, and it's really nice that it's being situated in a collection of other Black writing. And, it's a nice home for it.
One of the many special things about the book, but, yeah, Michaela reminded me, Forbidden Fruit is almost a poem. It's a micro story, and it's one of the first pieces I ever wrote as well. I've written a lot of things since then. But, yeah, it was a very early and kind of experimental pace where I was looking at how do you write a Black story without, you know, really just putting a sign around your neck and saying, hey, I'm Black or something. So, and it was also because I started very much with poetry and judicious choices of words, I guess. So, yeah, I think they did a great job there in terms of like showcasing in many ways the way the genesis and the evolution of many of these writers as writers.
Similarly, Janine, there's not a mention of my Aboriginality in my story.
No, yeah, that's right.
And I'm quite excited that it still can be included in, and very, very chuffed indeed to be in such illustrious company. And, yeah, just that, as you said, Michaela, the meta-narrative of the stories and how they flow from one to another and, you know, the thematics and the diversity of them. I think Ellen's done a brilliant job of curating this collection.
Yeah, and I think especially important is, you know, this is the first collection curated by a non-binary Aboriginal writer, which is historical, and it is a very, you know, it is a very queer collection. There's a lot of queer narratives in here, and it's really important that, you know, we're also having our time to shine, I think.
And seems to be part of Yeah, and I'm writing about this at the moment too. Across, I'm always interested in the trans geographic, the trans scene more broadly, but the trans geographic conversations between First Nations people, trans Tasman, trans Atlantic. So in First Nations North America, there's been some also stunning kind of collections of fiction and non-fiction that are by non-binary two-spirit poets and thinkers, and it really recognizes the way colonialism binarized things, and these works in as part of the meta story that Michaela mentioned and then Jane picked up on is one of the things this does is just challenge a lot of the limits that Western rationalism has previously imposed on First Nations people and writers, and a lot of that is those binaries and polarities that didn't exist in pre-colonial times. So it makes these works collectively make really important statements and are both individually and collectively really important decolonization spaces.
I would agree. I've always loved anthologies. I think it's a. I think it kind of stems back to my teenage years of, I'd get music magazines. I grew up in a regional town, so we didn't have the internet back then. And the only way to kind of find new music is, you know, compilations, music magazines, or someone would tape some stuff for you. And you'd figure out what you liked that way. And I see story anthologies as the same. I actually... the anthology that started me writing, my own writing a few years ago, was an anthology called Walking the Clouds, edited by Grace Dillon, who's an Anishinaabe scholar. Yeah. And it's a global anthology of Indigenous science fiction. And I loved it and I found so much in there and so much joy. I've reread it so many times. And I saw what Indigenous speculative fiction could do, and I started thinking about how I could write my own. I started reading everything that was available, and yeah, so I think anthologies are really, and I hopefully Flock does that to somebody else, you know, who picks it up.
So, and I also think the time is ripe for a collection of First Nations non-fiction in Australia. Out there, but the time is really ripe for that creative nonfiction collection gathering to come.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about
your next job, Janine.
Yeah, that's some publishers and things are listening.
Well, yes. Michaela, it's already done what you've hoped for. It's introduced me to both yours and Janine's writing. Jane, I had read Becoming Keralee Lewis already. And I've fallen in love with so many of these stories. And can I ask a little bit about the form? Because in their introduction, Ellen Van Nieuwen describes the precision of language of short story writing, having the right mix of narrative elements. They also describe, and I'm going to heartily agree here, that short stories are a gift to the reader. I've discovered so much already in Flock. And each of your pieces feel tightly drawn and incredibly personal in such a short space. I mean, I think of the three that we're discussing, Michaela, yours might be the longest at only 16 pages, but there is so much. How does a short story emerge for all of you? And Michaela, can I throw to you to start that one off?
Well, this one in particular started life in a creative writing workshop that I took at the University of Sydney back in 2017. So this is the second class I took. My teacher was Dr. Beth Yarp, who is an incredible person and writer. And she scaffolded, you know, a short story writing technique with us. So we started off, she wanted us to write, think about if we were going to write a novel, how would it start? And we just started anywhere. And I just wrote, the scene I wrote for that was the birth scene. And then she asked how that novel would end, and then I wrote something else that didn't make it into that story. But then she kept getting us to go back and forth, like what would come next, what would go before. And so in that way, I just wrote these series of scenes and it turned into that story. And I started to think about these connections and relationships through time. So I wrote most of those scenes for that class. Mind you, when I wrote it, the writing wasn't so good. This story, I have submitted it to, I think, 4 or 5 different opportunities, and they've been rejected for all of them. But the good thing about that is, for me anyway, so what will happen is I would submit the story, and it'll take 2 or 3 months for them to actually accept or to tell you that, you know, it's been rejected. But in that time, I'm not sitting around twiddling my thumb. I'm not working on that. I'm actually writing other stuff, and I'm reading, writing. I'm getting better at reading and writing. So when that rejection comes back and I get that story, and you get a bit of a sting when you get the rejection, but I read it and I go, oh, no, now I know it's working, and then I work on it. And I've done that a few times with this often rejected story, and I submitted it to the Elizabeth Jolly Short Story Prize last year. When I was broke and I was just trying to get somewhere, and the judges loved it, and that's it, and that's how it ended up in this collection. So that's how this story came about. Anyway, it's been a few years. It was a few years in the making and the polishing of it. Anyway,
Yeah, and I think a lot of good stories are like that, and that's how I sort of students workshop with me, and I think that you're never too old to workshop or never too good to workshop. I workshop my own work all the time and write it and rewrite it. And with the piece I wrote, it started as an observation. So it's almost, I use fictional devices to tell the story, but it could almost be nonfiction because it's based on an observation of a neighbor when I was living in a group house. When I was pregnant with my first child, actually. But and I was just sort of moving from how would you put that together? I wrote a little poem about it, but then I just sort of challenged myself, as you do. And Michaela mentioned opportunities, and at the time that story, the Canberra Times was running a little kind of mini competition where they asked for a micro story every week. Had to get a story into 500 words. And so that just seemed like something I could do from moving from poems to. So, yeah, that's the. And also, I was very much at the time challenging myself to, like what Jane said, to, you know, and thinking about what is Black writing and what do people expect? And you can't just write what people expect. Otherwise, that's just colonial writing. And you know, how to write a Black story without using a sledgehammer approach and putting a big sign up and saying this is a Black story.
Jumping in a deadly or a gammon just to
do that, yeah, just in case, just to make it unmistakable. But yeah.
And as for my story, I had the unusual experience, really. I was writer in residence at Monash University writing a play, and I put that down in an unusually short amount of time for me, because usually I labour over things for 7, 10, 15 years or so. But I put it down quite quickly in 6 weeks, and I had a bit of extra time up my sleeve. Now, obviously the experiences of born still, about having a stillborn baby, I experienced myself, and indeed the anniversary of that experience was only this Monday, just gone by. So how many years did I say? It's 24 years. So I had obviously that lived experience, and the story just went down pretty much in one go. Yourself, Michaela, I sent it off to a short story competition, and it didn't get anywhere. But when Ellen was doing an online resource, I sent it off to her, and it is the only short story I've ever had published, and the only one I've really written apart from sort of draft versions of various things. I think it's actually the hardest medium, right? I think just to have a beginning, middle and end in such a short space of time, take the reader on the journey with you, and have something that so crystallises in your writing in such a short space of time without the unfolding that a longer story or a full-length play has. Yeah, for me it's the most challenging.
It's interesting that you wrote that in fiction too, because like my piece, it could have almost been non-fiction. But yeah.
Absolutely. I think once it gets onto the page, that's when it becomes something other than just the lived experience. It becomes a creative act. And not that everything in the story did happen, but right. It's the way you frame that and the way you unpack it, I guess, becomes the creative element. Yeah.
I hear that. There's, you know, things in my story were definitely inspired by things that have happened to me and family members, but it actually, that is not a story. That is not a true story at all. Yeah. I've had people come up to me and go, oh, you know, assuming that my mum's passed away. My mum just lives down the road, you know. but that, you know, I was with my uncle who I was very close to when he passed away, and I was holding his head in hand. So, of course, that, you know, that was a really a huge experience in my life. So that's always, you know, of course, in your head. And when you start writing, when you're responding to a prompt in class, you know, you're not actually consciously thinking about what to write, and these things kind of seep out and they want to be known, they want to be written about. My old people, they want their stories to be written about. So when I start writing and these experiences come up, I know not to stop and just to keep going and to kind of honor what they're saying to me, what they're telling me to write about.
Can I ask a little about the imperative to tell stories just in general? Because one story that really jumped out at me, and I'm seem to be just keep talking about Ellen, but Ellen's story, Each City, which sets up this sort of dystopia. It's a future dystopia, but it feels like it could also be right now. But in this space, English is the only permitted language in the country. And the powerful voice of the protagonist writing and their hip-hop sees them targeted by the government, and yet they still tell their stories. And it's this harrowing journey. And I wondered about that need to tell stories and to continue telling stories even against oppression. And I'm very conscious that it's probably only my perspective as a white man that can see this as being so far away, perhaps from my daily experience. And I can see, Michaela, your facial expression says to me, yeah, you're right, Andrew, this is far from your daily experience, but not everybody's.
Yeah, it's look, I'm teaching at the moment. I'm teaching a unit about you know, Indigenous cultures and stuff, and we just had a class on language and education and you know, teaching and learning within Indigenous cultures. And something I like to really impress upon my students, and I'm going to talk about it here because it's relevant, is that had it not been for such strong storytelling oral tradition, yeah, in communities, we would have nothing left. Yeah. You know, people talk about how the written word is the best form of storing information, but look at what happens to the Great Library of Alexandria. And I absolutely guarantee that if all our knowledge had been written books, they would have been
burned. Yeah. Yeah.
What happened to our trees and our art and things that were written on? But because our old people carried this knowledge in stories and songs and were able to pass them down, that is why we still have what we have today, you know. So, yeah, so that Ellen's story is really just talking about what if that happened in a contemporary context, but it's not new. It's not
and
new.
It's also not out of the question. Like, it's also historical and scarily prophetic. And just to build on that, like, it could be prophecy as much as is history, in other words. And yeah, I teach I'm teaching at the moment too, and one of the subjects I teach is about not telling other people's stories or ethical writing, and you need to read other people's stories and learn other people's stories. Like, nations are built on literature, really. Nations are built on stories, whatever kind of nations they are, and when you kind of overwrite one set of stories for another, that's colonialism. So the importance of these stories are just, you know, absolutely, like, it is life itself. And also so important to that too is that people get to tell their own stories, and you and that you read about other people's stories. You read about, like, you know, like you said, that's so far away from your life. Yep. And I know you wouldn't have, but you never should have tried to write about that if you were ever thinking about it. But, you know, there's a lot of people who don't think. And there's this amazingly worrying trend, not helped by people like Lionel Shriver, who described cultural appropriation as a fad or something. Well, she wasn't the only one. She was just the most recent and loud, yeah. So, but, yeah, like that is also stealing other people's stories is like genocide. It's a death sentence. And so the importance of people having the space to tell their story, and also just want to can out the idea of the great white social justice novel, or this idea that people tell other people's stories because the people themselves can't tell them. Mm. Look, I'm sorry, any ethical advocate makes themselves redundant. So if you're concerned that a group of people doesn't have the space to tell their story, instead of telling the story for them, just move over, give them some space, make sure this, it's probably not because they can't tell their story, it's probably because the space isn't there.
Or someone else has taken that space
up. Or someone else has taken the space up and over.
There are plenty of people out there who, you know, they, whether it's, you know, culture or gender or disability, there are people out there who are speaking on these issues, and they're not the best place.
And quite frankly, they shouldn't be, because it's not their story. Yeah.
That's right. But anyway, I don't want to turn this into a big a big venting session. I'll do that enough. But, yeah. What do you think, Jane? Do you?
Yes, well, Janine said earlier that this collection is one aspect of decolonizing, and I agree that we are story. As human beings, we are story. Culture is carried through story, and that's what we've got. And so it's about time we had the space and audiences. I think audiences, building audiences for First Nations writing, is also really something I'm passionate about, because I think they are subtly different. I mean, most of us are bicultural. We exist in the Western world as well, and we can do the Western thing very well, just as well, if not better than other practitioners, but we also have our own stories and our own culture to reflect upon and to share, and I think it's a huge act of generosity for us to share our stories in these ways, and so that people get insight into different ways of being and different. I mean, I just think it's even really clever in this collection that that Ellen chose to do the stories alphabetically, but back to front alphabetically, starting with W and going to A in terms of the author's surname. So I thought,
I didn't even notice that.
I turned the alphabet upside down.
And I just think that that's, you know, a clever way that Ellen is again doing things slightly different and not having to just do it in the Western way every time, that she can do her own, they can do their own approach to putting this collection together.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm learning a lot. I'm glad you pointed that out, because I'm editing my own anthology at the moment, which will be out next year with UQP. And this is another world first. This is the world's first anthology of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander speculative fiction. So we've got horror, we've got sci-fi, futurism, ghost stories, you know, all that. I'm learning by looking at the way other people have curated. So Janine, your anthology too, poetry, and just seeing how things are put together and what kind of choices people make. And I, Yeah, I didn't even think about that, so thanks for pointing that out, Jane.
I observed across the collection and in each of your stories, strong bonds of family and particularly bonds between mother and child. And Jane, particularly in your story, Born Still, this incredible woman who is working, building a house, caring for her young child at 36 weeks pregnant, and just this incredible strength. And I don't know how to frame this question other than strength, but I hoped maybe we could talk a little bit about that strength and that endurance of particularly women that I saw in Born Still, but throughout the collection. And Jane, maybe I can throw to you to start this discussion since I've highlighted your story.
Strength. Well, thank you. That's very generous of you to say so. I think without saying gross generalisation, but I think Aboriginal women are incredibly resilient, and I think, you know, we've used to having so many things thrown at us through society that to survive we have to draw on, you know, these resources and the resources of the women who have gone before us as well, and draw on their strengths of our ancestors. And so I think often when things are tough, although I don't refer to it in that story, that I consider who has gone before me in terms of my heritage, and know that no matter what I have to go through, that many of those other women and men have also gone through much more difficult times than I have. And so I really got to pull my bootstraps up and get on with the job that I have to do, whatever that job is.
Yeah, I just want to agree with that. Like, I think that it is a responsibility. I mean, I was raised to understand that it was a responsibility to keep stories going and try and get a better story out there. And, you know, it is very much women who do that. Like, culturally, we had a role as gathering. Gathering sustains the whole clan. Hunting's glamorous, but gathering's what keeps going day to day. And and also just not physical things, but metaphorically too, gatherings, you know, the holders of stories, genealogies, givers of names, of, you know, generation, the kids. There's always someone who names the kids, and that's where I come from, always a woman. And so they're all those other sorts of gatherings as well. That like Jane said, yeah, it's a responsibility to be resilient. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Michaela?
Well, I definitely agree with, both of you, but I've just had a very different experience. So I never knew my grandmother. I never knew my great-grandmother, both stolen Aboriginal women. And I don't have a good relationship with my own mother, but I do have, I've got a lot of brothers, uncles, people, and that, you know, so growing up, those were the stories I was immersed in, and more of the men's side of things. So I don't really have that matriarchal kind of connection. Certainly in my community, you know, there's a lot of, you know, aunties and stuff, and I do feel I have those strong relationships, but in my own family I don't. I've only got brothers, I've only got uncles, and we've always been close, and it hasn't really been that kind of gendered or matriarchal way, but I certainly do have strong connections to previous generations and to generations coming up, and I cherish them. And and when I say previous generations and those coming up, I don't just mean my blood relatives. You know, I belong to a really incredible community who grew me up and who, all of my work and my writing is based here. And so to me, my family isn't just, you know, those blood connections, but it's the people who've invested in me and who I invest in. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's it for this great conversation with Michaela Saunders, Janine Lane and Jane Harrison. Each are contributors to the anthology Flock, First Nations Stories Then and Now, which is out now from University of Queensland Press. Great Conversations is recorded on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. Please stay in touch. I would love to hear what you're reading. I want to know what you're thinking about the stories that we're bringing to you. You can find Final Draft on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. It's at Final Draft 2 SER. If you want to get more Great Conversations, if you want to discover more about great Australian writing, subscribe to the podcast. There's a new conversation every week. There are bonuses. There's always stuff popping up. It will all be in your podcast feed as soon as it arrives. My name is Andrew Popel. I am going to be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. Thank you for joining me. Until then, happy reading. Bye now.